the desert oasis where stories ignite. Skip's little bar, a beacon of light. From the Coachella Valley stars to cool everyday movers and shakers on the show. Join Patrick and Randy, let the stories flow. At Big Conversations, little bar, the magic spreads near and far. Presented on Mutual by the McCallum Theater, candid tales are shared. Nothing could make this sweeter.
Welcome to the center of the Coachella Valley universe. You've made it to Skip Page's Little Bar with Patrick Evans and Randy Florence. Get ready for another fun and story-filled episode of Big Conversations, Little Bar, presented by the McCallum Theater. Order tickets now by visiting McCallumTheater.org or call the box office at 760-340-2787. Now, in their eighth season, here are your hosts, Patrick and Randy.
Well, thank you very much, Sebastian. We are back here at the wonderful corner booth at Skip Page's Little Bar in Palm Desert, California. That was a wonderful new theme.
It was.
Barry Manilow singing that? Did you get Barry to do that, John?
That was his brother, Al.
I tried my best, but it was his cousin.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right, well, that really very nice. Yeah. Smooth. I liked it. Yeah. Crooner-like. Outstanding. My name is Patrick Evans. This is Big Conversations Little Bar. My co-host, my spiritual guru, my good friend, my former life coach, Randy Florence, is here.
Former life coach?
Yeah, I fired you from that job.
That explains the checks. Checks stopped coming
there
in.
There were many reasons, but how are you?
I'm doing great. It's been a good couple. We haven't been together for a couple of weeks.
So it's been great.
And it's been amazing. Wow. Now that I've said that, I got to go.
Wow.
You had a pretty amazing trip.
Yeah, we went to Lithuania to see my brother-in-law.
The pictures look gorgeous.
It was really terrific. We had great weather there, although it did rain a good bit. But just, you know, that country continues to grow and expand. It's really come out of its shell from under the Soviet occupation. And I think really in the last 10 years, and I've been going there for a decade, it's really, the growth has accelerated. And it's just,
it's gorgeous.
Wonderful, vibrant place to go. Yes, sir?
Oh, I was just going to say, is that where lithographs are from?
That is where all lithographs.
The whole family.
That's okay. No, it was a great trip.
Well, I don't know if anybody else in the valley notices that you usually leave town about the time that the worst weather ever hits here. And I think it was 130 degrees the day after you left.
It was not 130. We got to 118, and I believe thermal got to 120. We set a couple of records.
But it's nice day, so thank you.
It's beautiful now. But it's universally true. If you've noticed, if I'm off for more than 2 days, you should probably leave town.
The weather's going to be bad.
That usually is.
Hey, I wanted to talk about one other thing.
Yes, sir.
What are we, 120 episodes into this, John?
I think we're in the one teens. We're close.
We are the impact that we are starting to have on this valley. I imagine the people in Cathedral City are pretty much loving Big Conversations Little Bar right now.
Or they're mad at you.
Why would they be mad at me? It immediately got safer. I've been bitching about the speed in this valley for a couple of years. And Cathedral City just announced that they're slowing them down. They didn't give us credit, but I'm taking it.
They did not. They actually gave, like, the Department of Highways credit, which is weird.
Is that Tom Kirk?
Yes, it is Tom Kirk.
Hey, I got to tell you, I got to take exception with Tom Kirk, who we had on the show recently.
Uh-oh.
Because
controversy.
I have been traveling up and down Ramon every day between Cathedral City and
you're
Palm
hitting a red
Springs
light?
To go over to or come back from our new offices and studios. And invariably, I am hitting not just a red light. I am hitting one after another, after another, after another. And it reminds me of an old Bill Feingold rant that he had on the air about, what is it with Cathedral City?
I think Tom put an air tag on your car.
That's right.
Every time you come up to a light, it's changing.
Wait, but there's more breaking news than that. We have new offices and studios?
We do.
Have you been to them?
I was
Randy?
Invited.
Oh, okay. Well, I was. I was not.
Yes,
we should get to our guest today.
We should get to our guest. We've only got 8 minutes left.
Patiently wondering if we're going to talk to him. Danny, welcome to the program.
Hi, it's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
It's really good
now,
to have
I want to make
you.
Sure I'm pronouncing you. I had you on Eye in the Desert, but it's been a little while.
And you got it right then.
Danny. I was right this time, too.
Laban.
Yes. Danny Laban. And you are now the CEO of the Jewish Federation here in the desert.
I am.
Welcome aboard.
Congratulations.
I started
April 1st, so we're going on completing 4 months very soon.
Okay, all right.
And it's been quite a 4 months.
It really has been. There has not been a dull moment. And I would say that's really true of my life getting here. I grew up in Southern California.
You're a UCLA guy.
I am. I graduated from UCLA.
With a degree in psychology.
Correct. Ooh, you did your homework.
Not really.
Okay, well.
Randy did.
Somebody did.
Randy did my homework.
Those notes.
Or is it just so obvious that I'm psychologically.
I have a soft place in my heart for you. My oldest daughter is transferring to UCLA out of UC Santa Barbara. So I get to spend Bruin football games there. So it's a good thing.
Really? Cool.
If we had a good football team,
you get
don't.
Tickets?
Yeah.
Oh, sweet.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. So you're a Southern California guy.
I am, but I've been in a lot of places since my early days in Southern California.
And you took your master's at Harvard.
I did. Master's in education, which was an excellent experience. And in many ways, it really set me off on a career trajectory that I had not expected. I grew up in LA, which obviously is a center for a lot of television and film.
Absolutely.
It never appealed to me. It never even occurred to me that I would do something related to television and film. But when I was studying education at the Harvard Graduate School of Education, I really became very, very intrigued and excited about the possibility of media to deliver educational impact. And one of the things that I did around the world was to produce Sesame Street in over 25 different countries, which was such an incredible experience.
And you were with that group a couple of different times in your career, weren't you?
I was. Yeah. I was there for 10 years, and then I left for 7 years, and then came back for another 7 years.
Wow.
And actually, it was in the break between Sesame experiences that I worked for Federation and got a lot of direct experience that's extremely relevant right now. But I do want to add, because this you may or may not have come across in your very extensive research about me, but I actually lived for 2 years in the country from which you just returned.
You lived in... I did not know
I
that.
Lived in Lithuania. Seriously. I lived in Vilnius.
You lived in Vilnius. Really?
I did. And
what were you doing there? Were you producing Sesame Street?
I was not. It was actually during the years that I was not with Sesame Street. My husband was a diplomat at the time with the Foreign Service, and we were posted to Lithuania, and it was an amazing experience. I actually, at the time, was working for the Jewish Agency for Israel, which is one of the partner organizations of Federation, and I was living in Vilnius, but overseeing all of the work taking place across the Jewish Agency in the countries and republics of the former Soviet Union. Okay. So I was traveling back and forth to Russia and Ukraine. This was in 2015, 2016, when that was possible. And also working with Jewish communities in the Baltics, in Lithuania in particular.
You know, it's a touchy subject in Lithuania because of the Holocaust and there was a level. I need to put this the correct way. I think there was a level of cooperation during the Nazi occupation because at one time, Lithuania and Vilnius in particular had an enormous Jewish population, which was almost entirely decimated during World War II. And
yes.
I think
Vilnius is often referred to as the Jerusalem of the East.
That's right.
Because it was such a center of Jewish learning and Jewish life, and the Holocaust put an end to that. There's a very small Jewish community there today, and many of the Jews living in Lithuania today actually are not historically from Lithuania. They came from other parts of the Soviet Union during the time of the Soviet Union when the government basically did these mass population swaps and tried to populate different areas with different groups. So many of the Lithuanian Jews today speak Russian and not Lithuanian, not because they're Russian sympathizers, but because that's the language that their families have spoken for a few generations.
What years were you in Lithuania?
I was there 2015 and 2016.
Okay. All right. Well, then we have overlapped because I was there in those in 2016.
Did you find it as Patrick does?
I actually thought your description was spot on, that it is such a dynamic country that is trying to really differentiate itself from its Soviet past.
Oh, yes.
And has really leaned so much into Europe and to the, quote, the West, progressive values. You know, it was really incredible to be there and to participate in what was Baltic Pride that took place in Vilnius, that was, I think, in some ways a turning point for the entire republic, because things like Pride had never existed.
It never existed
in the past.
Otis, a gentleman, I can't recall his last name, but he grew up with my wife, and he was an attorney, and he was one of the founders of Baltic Pride, and it helped to establish it in Lithuania. Lithuanian gentleman who grew up in L.A. And
You know,
yeah. So it was
interesting.
Yeah, it's a fascinating history, and you know, you look at those countries that were all stunted by 50 years of Soviet occupation, and some have really done better than others. But Lithuania leaned into the West and became part of the European Union, and you know, it's in NATO. Yeah. So,
how did the Sesame gig start for you originally?
So that
Randy's
actually
bored with the Lithuanian conversation, I could tell. Okay, that's fine.
Well, there's so much more in this world than just Lithuania, though. Honestly, I think we both could probably talk about it all day. Could.
No, I want to hear about the Sesame Street stuff. This is very cool.
Then we'll go back to Lithuania.
So, you know, as I mentioned, I really saw the potential of what mass media could do, especially in developing countries. And I was in my last semester of graduate school and randomly opened up the New York Times. I didn't even subscribe because I was a starving student who couldn't even afford that. But somehow I found a print copy of the New York Times by my dorm room. And I remember an article that it was on the front page, and it was basically an article speaking about a new initiative using Sesame Street to bring Israelis and Palestinians together to help foster a new Middle East and to prepare children for what was at the time a hopeful tomorrow where Israelis and Palestinians would live in a shared society side by side in peace. And this was in 1999, so still at the height of the Oslo Accord period, with a lot of hope for the future. And I just became completely mesmerized by the notion that Sesame Street, which of course I had grown up with as a child in the 70s, could communicate with children that effectively and that powerfully in different cultures.
Anywhere.
And I decided that this was something that I wanted to learn more about. And one of the assignments actually in a course I was taking, and it was very open-ended. It was like, share something amazing with the class kind of thing.
I like Elmo.
This is amazing, and I really want to become an expert in it, in as much as a, you know, a student can. And so this was the late 90s. I contacted Sesame Street, Sesame Workshop, which is the name of the nonprofit organization that produces Sesame Street, and they sent me VHS tapes that I watched, and I spoke with many of the producers and educators and researchers who had worked on the show, and I presented it to the class, and I got a very great grade on the paper that I turned in, and shared it, of course, with everyone back at Sesame Street. And then about a month after graduation, I was actually leading a summer program in Israel. So I was not even in the States, but I spoke with my mother. She was so excited because a voicemail had been left on the answering machine at their home in LA from somebody at Sesame Street who wanted to talk to me about a job. And
What a cool call that was.
It was a cool call. Yeah. And of course, I called back from Israel. And I was hired sight unseen because all of the work that we had done, and this was pre-Zoom, this was pre, you know, all we had was the good old phone. So I was hired based on the work that I had done and the impression, I guess, that I had made. So I was hired to work on the educational curriculum for what was going to be the next season of this Israeli-Palestinian Sesame Street. And so I was part of the international department, and I was working on a Sesame Street program in South Africa that debuted with an HIV-positive Muppet, which was an extremely critical initiative. The program actually launched in 2000 when more than 25% of South Africans were infected with HIV. And wow. The rates were astronomical, and everybody was affected in some way or another. So that was an incredible initiative. And I also worked on Sesame Street in Egypt at that time, in Germany, a lot of places.
All right, so I have a question, and I'm very curious about this. I grew up watching Sesame Street and enjoying it, but how does it cross those cultural lines? How applicable? I mean, obviously, you made significant inroads and making it relatable and trying to find ways to connect with the audience, but how did that transfer to different cultures?
Well, in many ways, Sesame Street made it easy because it turns out that there is truly something universal in the appeal of the Muppet characters. There's something about the way young children in particular connect with these puppets. None of it was accidental. There was a ton of research that went into it. In fact, much of that research took place at the education school at Harvard. And there's still an allegiance between Sesame and Harvard. So the research continues. But I don't think anybody involved even in the research really expected the kind of phenomenal impact that these characters and the whole format could have on kids and also on the whole children's television industry or media industry. That part on some level is universal, but each and every International Sesame project was and continues to be, even though I'm saying was because I'm no longer there, so right. I distance myself from it a little bit. It's they, it's not we. But
well, by the time this airs, you might be back there. So
No, I like my job here in the desert. I have no desire to go back.
He's only been here since April. Let's keep him a little longer.
I like working with the human characters here. They're interesting, too.
Randy's actually a Muppet. John controls him.
All right. Nice job.
That's why I keep smiling.
But basically, each and every international production of Sesame Street is created specifically for the population of children, addressing the most critical needs of kids in that particular country.
So the curriculum, yes. What would the difference be between what I'd see in South African Sesame Street versus
the
United States?
So you'd see some of the same characters, but you'd also see Muppet characters and human characters completely created specifically for that place. So in South Africa, for example, there is a Muppet named Cammy, and Cammy is an HIV-positive child. And through Cammy, a lot of modeling takes place around how one can and can't become infected, and acceptance, and really challenging a lot of stereotypes. So in Israel, for example, there are many familiar characters. Bert and Ernie appear with Hebrew names. But on the Israeli Sesame Street, there's also an Arabic-speaking Muppet named Mahbub, who's been a member of the cast now for going on nearly 20 years. And Mahbub is really a vehicle for Hebrew-speaking Jewish-Israeli children to get to know Arabs through a Muppet. And for Arabic-speaking children, for Palestinians living in Israel, to also have exposure to a sort of vision of a shared society that people can aspire to. And I think in some ways that really speaks to what Sesame Street, even in 1969 when it was created, was trying to do. It was grounded in reality. It was an urban New York street scene, but it was also not quite exactly reality, because in the Sesame Street reality, characters from different ethnic, religious backgrounds all live together in a very seamless way.
Yeah, there was always a great message of tolerance and acceptance and understanding our differences and how they make us better.
In the South African version of Sesame Street, was there a character, and did they have a subject matter of dealing with things like bullying like they do in schools here in the United States? And did they have like a bully Muppet character named Elon?
Wow, that was a long way to go.
You could have just started off with, I want to talk about Elon.
But I actually think
that was a long way to go to take a shot at Elon. But
and you know what? I think that's a great segue to a couple of things. One, sort of really underscoring the point that as much as Sesame Street has been able to take on and tackle some really difficult or seemingly controversial topics, it is strictly apolitical. So no, there would never be something like that. And I actually think the big segue here that I'm hoping to make is that in many ways that's also a reflection of the values of the Jewish Federation, where we are not a political organization. We are really committed to raising funding and then distributing, allocating that funding to as many organizations and populations who are in need, irrespective of political affiliations, and in some ways even irrespective of religious affiliations. We do provide services and funding for Jewish organizations here in the desert. But I just had lunch today with one of our grantees, the Meisel Center, which is a senior center in Palm Springs, familiar to many people. And we've been supporting the Meisel Center for 24 years consistently. We're, I don't know if we're the longest running funder, but that's one of many non-denominational relationships that we have and partnerships that we have here in the desert.
Well, and you also operate Jewish Family Service, which provides assistance to anybody in the community.
Absolutely. In fact, more than 90% of the service recipients from JFS, Jewish Family Services, are not Jewish. And that's very much in line with our universal values and a concept in Judaism called Tikkun Olam, which speaks to the responsibility that each and every individual has to do whatever they can to contribute to making the world a better place. And of course, there are a lot of ways that every person can do that. But when we think about Tikkun Olam, it's a very universalistic approach as opposed to particularistic, because we're really thinking about the world and all of its inhabitants. And so that really comes to play with our allocations that really span not just a very wide swath of organizations here throughout the Coachella Valley, but also to communities and organizations around the world. And a significant percentage of funding goes to organizations based in Israel. I came to Israel to produce the Israeli Sesame Street, and ended up staying there for a total of 13 years, and that's where I met my husband, and actually ended up accruing a lot of on-the-job experience with fundraising and with Jewish nonprofits, NGOs based in Israel, philanthropies based in Israel or based in the U.S. but working in Israel, and that was really exceptional experience for my current position. This is my first CEO position within the Federation system.
But you've worked within the Federation system before. For several years.
For about 5 years. Yeah. And that was, unfortunately, I'm going to say, really excellent on-the-ground training. And when I say unfortunately, I'm speaking specifically to the part of my job description in my former Federation job, which was responsibility and oversight of emergency allocations in times of crisis. And when I took that job in late 2011, I read that as part of my job description, because we all read our job description, and you know, there are a lot of bullet points, and okay, responsibility and oversight for emergency campaigns, and I thought, okay, great, what else?
Randy, a job description is what you get when you get employed and you have to,
ooh,
yeah.
And you need to read.
It's been a little while for you.
Read the fine print, because sometimes the things in the job description come up. So this is why I don't get a job. There's
exactly
all the stuff you have to do. Yes. So in the summer of 2014, there was something called Operation Protective Edge. I'm saying it's a something because it was technically never classified as a war, but it was a 50-day military operation, confrontation, fighting between Hamas and Israel. And during those 50 days, the Jewish federations across North America collectively raised over $50 million to support the needs of Israeli citizens and Israeli society, which includes Israeli Jews, Israeli Arabs, everybody living in Israel. And that was at the time the largest campaign for a crisis that had ever been raised. So it sort of pales in comparison to what federations have raised in the last nearly 2 years since October 7th,
right,
about $900 million,
unbelievable,
which is extraordinary. The single largest philanthropic supporter of the war relief effort for Israeli citizens and individuals. So that's amazing. But at the time, I suddenly found myself as being the point person for all of the emergency campaign work and for determining how to take $50 million that had come in basically in 50 days. It was basically $1 million a day for 50 days. It didn't work exactly quite that way.
Somewhere around a million.
And figuring out where the needs were greatest and where philanthropic funding would be the most meaningful and how it could complement other efforts underway, help to augment certain things that the government was funding, but certainly not give the government authorities a free pass and not replace their funding. And that's also a very tricky calculation. So I said, you know, unfortunate in terms of training, because I would have liked to have believed that that would have been the end of fighting and that we would not be where we are right now in the world with 21 months of ongoing war in the region, which of course has brought in so many other fronts. You know, it makes what happened a decade ago feel...
I know, it does look small by comparison, right, even though it was enormous. We need to take a very quick break and acknowledge our presenting sponsor, the McCallum Theater. I know that Sebastian did that in our open, but want to take a longer moment to recognize the McCallum and their contribution to make sure that we can continue to do this. We're grateful to the McCallum Theater, and don't forget to get your tickets. Season upcoming quickly. McCallumTheater.org.
The McCallum Theater's 2025-26 season is on sale now, featuring audience favorites and expanded programming with more than 20 brand new shows, including 7 Broadway shows with 4 desert premieres. Highlights include a robust offering of holiday events and a great lineup of classical, dance, comedy, cabaret, and more. The McCallum entertains, educates, and enriches the Coachella Valley through world-class performances at the desert's premier performing arts center. We kick off the season on September 10th with the Righteous Brothers. John Lovitz brings his comedy to the McCallum on September 13th. Mexican regional vocalist Camila Fernandez is in concert on September 14th. And on September 21st, comedian Monique Marvez brings her smart, sexy, and self-aware humor to the stage. Tickets are on sale now at McCallumTheater.org or by calling the box office at 760-340-2787. Your entertainment, your theater, the McCallum Theater.
All right, we are back with Danny Lehman from the Jewish Federation. He is the CEO of the Jewish Federation of the Desert. We were just talking about, you were in Israel a decade ago, the point guy for the aid that was flowing in, and you were sort of in charge of disseminating that in appropriate ways. And it was kind of on the job training for later work with the Federation here now, and obviously I think we're still involved in a massive fundraising campaign to help the citizens of Israel during this current conflict.
Absolutely. And what we're really experiencing and have experienced in the last 6 weeks is a war inside of a war and then the aftermath of that war inside of a war. And what I mean specifically is the 12 days of missile exchanges between Israel and Iran that started on the 13th of June. And I actually...
You were there.
Let's talk about that. Yes, yes, I actually was in Tel Aviv when that started. It was the end of the fifth day of a Federation mission, a trip that was organized for 100 members of the LGBTQ plus community from across the country, from the U.S., and there were a few Canadians too, so we'll say from North America. And
our 51st state.
Well, I'll say the U.S. and Canada. And among the 100 participants, there were 7 from the desert who were part of the group. And we spent about a week going and paying homage and expressing our solidarity with some of the communities and individuals who suffered firsthand on October 7th when the massacre took place and the many atrocities along the Gaza border, the kibbutzim, the collective farms, and the Nova Music Festival, where 378 people were killed at that festival on October 7th, and I believe 44 people specifically from that festival were taken hostage to Gaza. Some were still in Gaza. So we visited that site. We met with some of the hostages who had been released and had come back home since October 7th. We met with the families of bereaved families of hostages who were killed. And it was an extremely intense and emotional experience. It actually also really brought the group together in a very, very palpable way. I'm going to even say profound way. That, you know, for many people who identify as part of the LGBTQ plus community and who are Jewish, the last nearly 2 years since October 7th has been truly a watershed moment, but not in a positive sense. It's been a moment of very stark realization where many Jews have come to realize that they're not welcome in some of the progressive spaces that they were comfortable in, especially if they identify as Zionist and supportive of an Israeli entity, the State of Israel. So it was an extremely important experience that 100 Jewish leaders from around the U.S. and Canada could come together and experience not just the solidarity with Israelis and everything that's happened, but also with our own collective and very shared experience. Doesn't matter where people were from, the same themes are emerging in many, many places. And so not only was all of that really, really powerful for everyone, but I think that when on Friday, the 13th of June, at around 3:15 in the morning, the first missiles from Iran began falling on Israel and in the Tel Aviv area, very close to where we were staying, instead of everybody sort of freaking out, which is a totally valid response.
100%. You know, I certainly would have.
Missiles coming at me.
Yeah, it's a drag. So everyone could have been sort of the most... the biggest mess of themselves in that moment. But I think having experienced a week of that solidarity and knowing what Israelis have gone through, not even just for the last 2 years, but for the last many, many years, of living in a prolonged state of war or virtual war at any moment kind of thing. I think all 100 participants were really, really brave and focused on how do we came here as part of a solidarity mission. How do we continue to provide that kind of support while at the same time being really scared and wanting to go home because Israeli airspace was closed.
Closed. You couldn't get out.
We couldn't get out. So
this happened on a Friday.
Yes.
What did you Were they given any instructions or expectations or anything leading up to that
duck.
Friday? Because everybody was figuring there was going to be a response.
Right. So,
duck.
Well, basically, I mean, it was, yes, fine. Find a bomb shelter.
And they have
get underneath this school desk.
A really remarkable civil defense infrastructure there. There are yes. there are bomb shelters readily available.
There are bomb shelters in all new construction. But in older buildings that were constructed before a certain date, I think sometime in the early 90s, I think it was actually a result of the Gulf War and the Scud missiles from Iraq at the time
right.
that prompted changes in the building codes. But anything that was built before the 1990s does not have necessarily, unless it's been remodeled, a shelter or a safe space in the building. Some people have a shared one on a floor. Some people have a shared one in the basement of a building, and some people have to go to a communal shelter that involves leaving one's residential facility, whether it's a home or apartment
building, leaving all your possessions
and running across the street to that space. So there was a lot of running back and forth to the shelter. And, you know, Israel has had a lot of rockets in the last 21 months since October 7th, 2023. There have been rockets from Gaza. There were rockets in the north from Hezbollah and Lebanon. There were two earlier rocket incidents. One, I believe, in April of 2024. And then there was one on October 1st, 2024, where Iran sent rocket barrages. But those were very controlled. They were announced in advance, and people were told, in the next few hours, there will be a rocket barrage from Iran. We'll let you know when we know more.
Film at 11.
Basically, it was that. I mean, my husband and I and our dog, we were just sitting in the living room of our apartment, watching television, waiting. They actually, that was the wow. April time, and they came earlier than expected. So we knew to go to the shelter, and then when it was over, when all the missiles had fallen and most of them were intercepted either by the Israeli defense equipment or by other regional allies who had intercepted the missiles before they even got into Israeli territory, the UK, the US, also Jordan was one of the allied partners in preventing.
That's fascinating.
Yeah, it really is. Well, and it's also even comes back because our group, most of our group actually left through Jordan, which is how we came back before Israeli space reopened 12 days later when the missile ended. But to take us back to that earlier time when the missiles fell, once the missiles fell, Iran made a very pointed statement saying our what they called a retaliation because they claimed it was a retaliation, but our retaliation has now concluded. Basically, you may return to your regular schedule.
Right. Film at 11.
And it really was, and that's what it was. I mean, it was over.
That's crazy.
It was just a safe face show of force.
Yeah.
But you know, this most recent attack was
this
not.
This was not, no. And this was very, very premeditated in as much as the missiles were pre-programmed to hit residential centers. There were 31 communities that were hit. There were thousands
of people. Were these the older communities that didn't have all the infrastructure, the bomb shelters
not,
and all of that?
No, not necessarily.
It was just wide
it
range.
Was across the board, okay. And there were so many coming.
It was targeted at civilian populations.
Yeah, and I'm not sure, I don't know anything about rocket and missile defense, but I think there was something about these Iranian missiles that the defense equipment, the Iron Dome and other mechanisms that exist in Israel, weren't as prepared or able to deter at the same level. They have other rockets from other regional foes, including the Houthis from Yemen, who have been sending periodic rockets.
But this time around, the Iranians were really launching more sophisticated armament.
Yes, and you know, it was maybe their maps were a little old because they hit the largest hospital in the south of Israel, Soroka Hospital in the city of Be'er Sheva. They actually hit the old surgery building, which is being used for something that wasn't even, there wasn't anyone in it. So they may have had not the most recent information.
Bad intelligence.
But they were trying to do the most damage with whatever intelligence they had.
They need to update their Garmin GPS, but that's right. What was your first reaction? I mean, you're here on this goodwill mission and you're essentially now trapped in a country that is under attack.
And I'll tell you, my first reaction as an Israeli, even though I was born and grew up in Southern California, I immigrated to Israel and I have an Israeli passport. I'm an Israeli citizen. And I did not serve in the army, but I feel like I really have committed much of my life to contributing to the future of the Jewish people and to Israeli society. And I felt like, how could I leave? When you take on citizenship, there's an inherent responsibility, at least I believe. And even though I'm not living in Israel at the moment, I felt like, well, I'm here now, so I can't leave. You don't run away when the going gets tough. Mm-hmm. I need to be here and somehow do something. That was my initial reaction. But the more I sat in bomb shelters and the more I heard explosions around me and felt the vibrations of explosions, and when our own apartment in North Tel Aviv had the windows blown out because a missile fell about 300 feet away, I felt, wait a minute, A, there's nothing I can do right now to help. I'm just a sitting duck, and there's nothing that my staying here is actually going to do to contribute to making this situation better. But then I had, I think, even a deeper realization, which was my responsibility now is to the Jewish community in the desert. I am the leader of the Federation, and this was my decision, and I'm grateful for the opportunity. I'm happy for the decision I made. And if I stay here, instead of taking the opportunity to come back as soon as I can, then perhaps there are things I could be doing for the community here in this moment that I wouldn't be able to do. So when I had that realization,
suffering here.
Oh, absolutely. And I'm so glad I came back, because not only did we raise additional funding, which is important because that money is going to go directly to support the needs of people who lost their homes, who were injured, who are in trauma, who need psychological counseling, all of that. So that fundraising effort was really critical. But I felt like this community also needed leadership in that moment. And I was able to bring people together from across the desert and have a community briefing. I spoke at different synagogues. In fact, I'm speaking at another synagogue this Saturday morning for Shabbat. So I feel like, you know, I was really able to get back here quickly and fulfill my duties that I take very seriously.
Well, and you bring the unique perspective of having been through this not once, but a couple of different times.
Yeah.
I think it's really important. And because the mission of the Federation here in the desert and across the country, I think, is much more heightened now, and I think people understand, because, you know, the war continues and the need continues to grow. And as you point out, there's the rising tide of anti-Semitic acts here in this country.
Yep, absolutely. That's taking place, and, you know, a lot has been conjectured and written about sort of how do events taking place in the Middle East impact some of the rise in anti-Semitism that we're seeing. But there are also those who have postulated, and I think there's a lot of credence to the argument, that anti-Semitism has existed ever since the beginning of
religion.
Jewish history. For more than 3,000 years, there have been anti-Semitic events. And, you know, there was an anti-Israel sentiment in the United States that erupted immediately following the October 7th massacre. On October 8th, 2023, before there had been any retaliatory strikes or anything that Israel had done, people were already coming together on campuses to...
Well, they're bad actors and agitators who were perhaps just...
waiting for an
clearly,
opportunity.
Yes, looking for that opportunity. Right. And this was the opportunity that presented itself.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Danny, you used the word a few minutes ago, deeper. All of this stuff that you're talking about is deep inside of you, and it's obviously driven you in your couple of different careers here. Where did this come from? Did you grow up in a family that was active, or what built that up inside of you to want to get involved?
You know, I don't think I necessarily even understand my own sort of secret sauce. You know, I think there are probably a lot of factors. First of all, I think my parents are the two best people I know. Mm-hmm. And I say that while also recognizing that I vehemently disagree with them on many, many topics. And yet I recognize their goodness and their wisdom. And I think that's actually helped me to develop an appreciation for and a curiosity for understanding people's opinions, even when I don't agree with them. Right. So I do credit, and I think that's actually a big piece of what's motivated me in trying to understand other people's experiences, other people's perspectives, and knowing that understanding them doesn't necessarily mean agreeing with them, yeah. but that there's something really valuable in creating that empathy.
Well, that's a distinction that's lost these days. People don't feel like...
Well, empathy's lost.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think people really feel in this day and age that if I disagree with you, and not only that, I have to hate you for that, too. Mm-hmm. And I think that's that's a newer phenomenon in our society. It didn't used to be like that.
It is, and I'm really grateful for having had this experience within my own family, because I'm not quick to dismiss people with whom I disagree, because why do that? There's other value in maintaining that relationship that can be found. And it's not always readily apparent or easy, but if you go deep, it's there. Yeah. So I think to answer your question, I mean, I went to a Jewish day school and learned Hebrew growing up. But so did my brother and sister. And neither of them chose to move to Israel and dedicate their lives to working in the Jewish community. Mm. So... you know, we're all different in the family, and of course, my brother, sister, and I are all different. We share certain familial characteristics, but and I'm not really sure how to pinpoint why this became such a passion point for me. I will say that understanding my own identity and who I am has always been sort of a flame lit beneath me.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, in some ways... I came out a little bit late. I came out in my early mid-20s. And I was really focused on sort of developing my sense of Jewish identity. That was really, really important to me in my late teens and early 20s. Maybe it was a safer way to explore identity. Because even though the 90s... were probably better than the 80s, that were better than the 70s and better than the 60s in terms of LGBTQ equality, rights, acceptance. But, you know, it wasn't what it is today. And still today, there are a lot of challenges. Yeah. So we need to recognize those too. But I think I really leaned in to my Jewish identity. And I'm sort of grateful for doing that, because I think it gave me a lot. And, you know, there are times when I find myself, you know, if I had done this differently, you know, what if I'd gone to a different school, or I'd done this or hadn't done that? But at the end of the day, I'm really pleased with my current reality and where I've ended up. Both
look where you're sitting now.
Yeah, exactly.
Right.
In a bar.
The jagged road that led you to big conversations, little bar.
Right? Yes.
Talk a little bit about what you feel is your mission as the head of the Jewish Federation here in the desert. Where does that organization, where do you want to take that organization?
So one thing that I think the desert has going for it is people's desire for community. I think people who come here to the desert if they haven't grown up here, are coming at a later stage in life and they want to be involved. They want to get to know people. There's a certain drive people feel to forge community. And offering a Jewish communal experience for people that is enriching and fulfilling and that offers people value with chances for people to come together and experience Jewish life and celebration in a very positive way is a big piece of it. I mean, we fundraise, we raise money, and we need to obviously grow that to be able to do more. But I really see us at a pivotal moment where being able to give people something meaningful to bring them into the community and into the organization ultimately is really important, because there are so many wonderful nonprofits and charities in the world, but in the desert, you know, there are hundreds of them. So we need to be able not just to distribute money, which we do, but we need to also really give people something that contributes to the sense of community that they're really seeking in being here. So more programming, community events, speakers, opportunities for adult learning, trips to Israel like the one that I just came back from that was specific to LGBTQ, but there are any number of opportunities that we could create here for people to go to Israel in all sorts of ways. One of the sort of dreams that I have is to have a sort of birthright trip to Israel, but for people who have never been, who are later in life. And that could be a really, really extraordinary experience.
One of my coworkers is in Israel right now. He landed yesterday doing that birthright experience.
So birthright is usually for people up to age 25.
Yeah.
I'm thinking of, and actually I know who you're talking about, because when I was in your studio,
Spencer,
for the Eye of the Desert, he told me he was going to go on a birthright trip this summer. So he's there. Amazing that that happened. And that was scheduled for now and not a month ago, because then
it's been touch and go. I mean, Spencer and I have been talking about this, like, are you going? Do you still want? He's like, I really want to go, but, you know. And
shout out to Spencer.
He's having I've gotten a couple messages. He's having a great time.
But what I'm talking about is a trip for older people, you know, 55 and over, who've never been, to really experience what Israel is and its centrality and importance to Jewish identity. And also, I think having that kind of experience, and even going back to the group I was with, the 100 people who were there during the war, we will be connected forever to each other, but also to the experiences that we had and how those experiences will continue to shape us, the decisions we make, the roles we take within our own community, whether we decide to become activists when things happen or we turn away. I think those are all really, really important things.
Wow.
Phenomenal.
Pretty important stuff.
Danny, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This has been great
to be here.
So interesting. And just fascinating. Thank you.
Thank you.
We haven't had a lot of people. We've had a lot of people on here, but with the conviction behind what they were talking about, this is really powerful. Well, I'm glad you were here.
I do think you're one of the few people that we've had who has been taking missile fire for their convictions. I don't recall anybody else telling that story.
I'd probably trade that in. But,
well, welcome to the desert community.
Yes,
I think you have discovered how welcoming and warm and lovely this community is. And I know that you've only been here since April, but it's a really remarkable place.
No, we already feel very much a part of this community, and it's one of the reasons that we chose the desert as opposed to other opportunities. So we are home.
Well, I can state unequivocally that your experience on Big Conversations, Little Bar, we are part of the fabric of this desert.
See, I was just going to tell him that I thought he'd probably recover from this.
Well, what if I told you that being a guest on your show is the reason we moved here?
And how can people learn more about the Federation?
Well, we have a website, and everyone is welcome to check us out at www.jfedps.org.
jfedps.org.
Exactly.
And we're going to put that up when we post this. But, you know, so
we also have a Facebook page. So look us up on Facebook, Jewish Federation of the Desert.
Follow them, like them on Facebook. Go to the website. You guys are doing important work in troubled times. Yeah. So we appreciate you taking this time. Really just a terrific conversation.
And we're glad you're here.
We're delighted you're here.
To be here. Yes.
Nice on behalf of my great co-host, Randy Florence, thank you, sir.
And wherever Howard is, we miss you, Howard.
Well, God bless Howard. Yeah. But Sebastian's doing a great job so far. Danny Laban, thank you so much, the CEO of the Jewish Federation of the Desert. And John McMullen, our producer, thank you, sir. There's so much work that goes into editing one of these episodes and putting it all together, and you do a great job of it.
Thank you.
Thank you all for listening to this edition of Big Conversations Little Bar. Please be sure to subscribe so you never miss an episode, and we're available on all of your favorite podcast platforms. Our thanks to the team here at Skip Page's Little Bar. They always take very good care of us. And don't forget, support the McCallum Theater.
Thank you for joining us on this episode of Big Conversations Little Bar, recorded live at Skip Page's Little Bar in Palm Desert, California, the center of the Coachella Valley universe. This program has been presented by the McCallum Theater. Learn about upcoming performances and other community offerings at McCallumTheater.org or call the box office to purchase tickets by phone at 760-340-2787. This program is a production of the Mutual Broadcasting System and is available from Amazon Music, Apple Podcasts, Audible, Captivate.fm, Spotify, and YouTube.
Big Conversations, Little Bar with Patrick and Randy, presented by the McCallum Theater.